Let me begin by thanking the organizers, especially Eva, for inviting me to this very stimulating workshop. I had a talk, keeping in mind that there might be a few observers in the audience. That is almost not the case, so maybe the talk isn't quite appropriate for the people, but we can always modify it. I wanted to give this talk to observers because, as you all know, we were subjected to a rather large dose of data last week, which was great. But if you're a theorist like me, way off in theory land, then you're probably still in recovery from that. And I felt this week we should try to seek revenge. So this was my feeble attempt to do so. Wisely, the observers have mostly stayed away. So anyway. The title of my talk is CMD from CFT, and what I'm trying to do is ask whether the symmetries of conformal field theory can teach us anything about the early universe, in particular the inflationary era, which might then have also implications for the CMD. This is work that's been done. Subrat Raju, who's now faculty at the newly founded International Center for Theoretical Sciences, and Ishan Mata, who was until recently my graduate student, but after finishing this work, he was so perturbed by the fact that his research could even in principle have observational consequences, although not anytime soon, that he panicked and has quit string theory and decided to instead work in algebraic geometry. So that's a great loss. He was really very bright, but anyway, that's how it goes. Yes.
I have a question. So the South Pole Telescope is possible?
Thank you. Yeah, that's a good joke. That's right. Some of the consequences can be tested now. Probably not in the CMB, actually, as you'll see. Maybe in large-scale structure. Who knows? We'll see. So there won't be any punchline in terms of immediate observational consequences, but I think it's an interesting analysis. And in principle, if our observer friends could get their acts together, then in the future there could be some interesting consequences. Okay, so I'll begin with an introduction. As I say, I didn't quite prepare this talk for the knowledgeable audience here, but anyway, let me stick to it. So I'll start with an introduction, introduce some of the basic ideas that will provide the groundwork, and then we'll turn to a more systematic sort of thinking about symmetries and what is the most useful approach within which to think about the symmetries of De Sitter space and so on. And here we will borrow heavily or motivate ourselves from what happens in anti-De Sitter space. We won't assume, I should say right away, any kind of precise DS-CFT correspondence. It's far from clear if there is such a correspondence. But just to organize our thinking about symmetries, it will be useful to see how in the ADS-CFT correspondence, the symmetries of the bulk get reflected in the boundary conformal field theory, and that will then help us in thinking about symmetries for De Sitter space as well. I'll then turn to a specific correlator and show you how the symmetries, in fact, are quite powerful in determining it, and determine it completely. And so that will be an example of the general kind of thinking, and then end with conclusions. So, as you all know, during inflation, the universe was approximately De Sitter space, and the symmetry group of four-dimensional De Sitter space is SO1, 4. This is a big symmetry group. The question we will ask is, what constraints does this symmetry impose on correlation functions of the quantum perturbations produced during inflation? Okay, so that's the basic question we'll try to go after. And the answer we'll find, just to tell you the punchline, is that sometimes, in fact, symmetries can be quite powerful, and in the one case we'll, as I said, analyze completely, it'll end up determining the correlation function completely. The functional form will get fixed by the symmetries to be unique as a function of the various momenta, and the normalizations, the overall normalization will also be fixed in terms of the normalizations of the scalar and tensor perturbations. Now, the motivation for thinking in terms of symmetries is just the basic one, which is if you have an argument based on symmetries, then it's robust and it doesn't depend on any particular model, as long as the model, of course, has those symmetries. And I think this is particularly important in the context of inflation, which is often described as a compelling paradigm without a particularly compelling model. So it's nice to ask what properties that you derive actually just occur due to the symmetries in the problem. Another consequence of not depending on models is that sometimes you might have situations where you cannot, for example, calculate, given our present knowledge, the consequences in terms of the production of quantum perturbations. And in that case, a direct calculation may not be possible. But if the symmetry, if the model still has the symmetries we are using, then the consequences due to symmetries would, of course, hold. For example, this could happen if inflation occurred at a high scale, say of order the string scale, if the Hubble scale was of order the string scale. We know from the fact that tensor perturbations are not produced, are in fact quite suppressed, that the Hubble scale must be quite small compared to the Planck scale, but the string scale can be small compared to the Planck scale, the 4D Planck scale, because there are various moduli, as we all know, that go into determining the Planck scale in terms of the string scale. So it's a possibility that the Hubble scale is of order the string scale. And in that case, Einstein gravity would no longer suffice to describe what is going on. Higher order corrections would be important and would need to be incorporated, although loop corrections would still be small, still M string is, since M string is smaller than M Planck. So we might have...
Do you have in mind really somewhere in the middle of the R of string theory where...
For example, yeah.
Moduli,
yeah.
Way up there.
Yeah.
Control,
that's right.
That's right.
I'm not saying I have a model. I'm not saying I have a controlled situation in string theory for sure.
But
that's right. This would be the case. And it's the analog of what would happen in ADS space if my Tuff coupling was order 1. And then the radius of ADS would be of order.
Is there a reason to think that you would keep in from one variance? Like string physics itself couldn't break it?
That's a good question. It could be, and I'm going to just come to that, which is that it could be that even though the geometry is approximately De Sitter space, the entire dynamics does not preserve, for example, conformal invariance. This is a possibility. And in that case, these consequences wouldn't apply. But it is a possibility that the entire dynamics does approximately preserve conformal invariance. So that's an example. As I said, I don't have a well fleshed out model of this type, but it remains a possibility.
You pointed partly that these are symmetries regardless of this, whereas we couldn't just do usual computations in this case.
Exactly. So then just to say this, given a poor understanding, we couldn't directly calculate in such a scenario, however, the symmetry considerations would still apply. Now, for me, it was kind of surprising when I first started thinking about this, that the consequences of symmetries has not already been thoroughly investigated. Because after all, inflation has been much studied, and so you have thought that this is something that would have been analyzed to death already, but it hasn't been done fully. There was of course, Maldacena's very classic paper now in 02, where he calculated the non-Gaussianity for slow roll inflation that sort of, in a sense, put in many of the key ideas. And then they were developed further in terms of the use of symmetries in the paper by Maldacena and Pimentel. And what they did in this paper was to really apply these ideas to calculating the three-point tensor perturbations, so three graviton correlation function, and they had a rather interesting set of results for that case, just coming about from conformal invariance. And so that's kind of interesting, but as you know, tensor perturbations are hard to measure, and if one is talking about three-point functions, this is the hardest correlation function to be able to measure because it has three gravitons. Correlation functions involving scalar perturbations are easier, they are bigger in magnitude, easier to measure. And so the natural question was, can you extend some of this analysis also to correlation functions involving scalar perturbations? And that's what we'll try to do, and at least take it through in one case, which is to look at a correlation function which has two scalar perturbations and one tensor perturbation, where symmetries are pretty powerful. Of course, the most interesting correlation function is the one which has three scalar perturbations, and for various reasons which I'll come to at the very end, that's quite challenging in terms of applying the ideas of conformal invariance. But I think something might perhaps still, one might still perhaps be able to say something there. It's work which is ongoing. You can put a bound on how big the three-point scalar correlation can be if you had approximate conformal invariance in terms of the breaking of conformal invariance and so on. But finding the exact functional form in general is much more challenging. Okay, so let me tell you a little bit more quickly about the symmetries of the Sitter space, since they'll be so crucial. Well, here's the metric, and I guess it's called co-moving coordinates. H is the Hubble constant, and the symmetry group SO1, 4 has 10 generators. Some of these are manifest as isometries. There are three translations. Since nothing depends on the xi's, those are symmetries. There are three rotations, since this metric is flat, those are isometries. There's a scale transformation, which is also very familiar, where you shift time by a constant and rescale the x's to undo that, so that that's an isometry as well. So that accounts for 7 of the 10 symmetries, and it leaves 3, which are 3 more isometries, which are not so easy to see. And these are the special conformal transformations, and these will be particularly important in our discussion. The constraints they impose, it turns out. And here I've just, sorry, this can barely be read. Tried to write down these transformations for you. It doesn't matter what they are. There's a vector which takes 3 values, so 3 parameters, which are the parameters that specify the 3 conformal transformations. Okay, now the group SO1, 4 is also the symmetry group of a 3-dimensional Euclidean conformal field theory, and for that reason we'll call it the conformal group, and we'll actually use this analogy more and more as we go along in the talk. Here is my, I try to prepare some slides keeping in view the broad audience, and here was my attempt, pathetic attempt, to draw a hyperboloid using PowerPoint. Anyway, one way to understand why the Sitter space has a symmetry group, which is SO1, 4, and Don also said this in his talk in the conference, is to think of the Sitter space as a hyperboloid in 5-dimensional Minkowski space. So if we take 5-dimensional Minkowski space with x1, x2, and x0 time-like, and we look at this hyperboloid, then what you get as the induced metric, starting with the flat Minkowski on this hyperboloid, is the de Sitter metric. And since the hyperboloid preserves the Lorentz group in 5 dimensions, 4 plus 1 dimensions, and the underlying metric does too, the resulting metric you get in the de Sitter space is also, has also the isometric group SO1, 4. Now you can take another hyperboloid in 5-dimensional Minkowski space, which lies in the upper wedge, say, or the lower wedge, but let's take the one in the upper wedge just to draw it. And in that case, what you get is again a space with the same symmetry group, SO1, 4. In this case, it is Euclidean ADS space. Okay, and so there is, I went through this a little bit just to tell you that there is a rather close relationship between, at least at the level of symmetries and so on, between Euclidean ADS space and de Sitter space. And of course we know that the symmetries of Euclidean ADS space are those of a 3-dimensional Euclidean conformal field theory as part of the ADS-CFT correspondence that everybody knows about now. So then it follows, since de Sitter space is the same symmetry group, that that's also the symmetry group of 3D Euclidean conformal field theory. Okay, now of course you would say that during inflation the geometry is not exactly de Sitter space, and corrections are present, but they are small, or they can be small rather, and the breaking of conformal invariance can be measured in terms of, for example, the slow roll parameters. Here I've written 2 of them that come from the metric itself, h dot over h square, which I'll call epsilon 1, and delta, which has the second derivative of the Hubble constant. And the measurements we've made so far on the tilt and so on tell us that these should be small. Okay, let's say about 1 part in 100 or so. Now, of course, there's more to inflation than just the metric and the dynamics of the metric. There's also a scalar field, say in the simplest model, you have an inflaton and the scalar field rolls and that drives then the evolution of the geometry. And for our symmetry considerations to hold then, they should apply to the full inflationary dynamics, not just gravity, but also the scalar sector, which must also preserve the SO1,4 symmetry to good approximation. Okay, and this is not automatic, but it is only in situations, circumstances where this happens that our symmetry arguments will apply. And to see why this is not automatic, let me put it like this. We know so far, what do we know about assuming that inflation was responsible for the perturbations that we see in the CMB? What do we know? We know that the perturbations were approximately scale invariant because the two-point function that is observed in the temperature fluctuations is approximately scale invariant. NS is 0.96. It would have been 1 for exact scale invariance. Now, if you take a time-dependent metric and you require that it is translationally invariant in the spatial directions and rotationally invariant and also scale invariant, then that leads to de Sitter space automatically. Namely, imposing besides translations and rotational invariance, scale invariance gives you the full conformal group as far as the metric is concerned. But this doesn't have to be for a scalar field. And that was just to remind you, this doesn't have to be for a scalar field, but you can have translational and rotational invariance for a scalar field background and also scale invariance, but not conformal invariance. For example, suppose you have a scalar field theory of this type, kind of Lifshitz type, where you have 4 derivatives in the action for space directions, but only 2 for time direction. And suppose a theory like this governed the small perturbations on the scalar sector, then what could happen is, then you would have translational invariance and rotational invariance because the spatial directions all contracted nicely. And you'd also have a skin symmetry, but one where if time had weight 1, then spatial directions would have weight half. And so, so in this situation, you would have a scaling symmetry, but you wouldn't have a full conformal group. And in fact, there are well-known examples, for example, DDI inflation or ghost inflation and so on, where this does happen, where you have a scalar sector which does not preserve the full conformal group. And then these considerations won't apply. I should say that some of these theories are disfavored by Planck data. It's too early to say that they're ruled out. You can parameterize, these theories come with a speed of sound, which is different from 1. And that speed of sound, there are bounds on it, but they're not ruled out, I would say, so far. But anyway, to some extent, you'd say that the data indicates that you're perhaps not with big deviations from the speed of sound being 1. So, okay.
It's 0.01-ish.
Yeah.
Right now.
Yeah. CS has to be just greater than, yeah. So there's a lot of room between that and that's all I was trying to say. But. There's some indication, let's say. It could have been already that. It could have been that already the non-Gaussianity was big enough in the three-point scalar correlator that you could have ruled out the possibility that the entire inflationary dynamics preserves approximate conformal invariance. And I'll come back to that point at the very end. Okay, what kinds of situations would our considerations apply to? Well, the simplest model is just a canonical model of slow roll inflation, just one scalar field with a potential, where the potential is slowly varying. In the limit then, where the potential doesn't vary at all, it's flat. You have conformal invariance, not just in the metric, but also in the scalar sector, because if you look at the scalar sector in that limit, which determines the small perturbations and their correlations, it's very easy to obtain. You write phi as the background value plus delta phi, and then to quadratic order, if the potential is flat, the actual Lagrangian governing the perturbations is just that of a free field in de Sitter space, and that, of course, inherits all the symmetries of de Sitter space. So that's a very simple example, but good to know that it lies in this class. And then So this here are the symmetries of the geometry, asymmetries of the perturbations. I'll be more careful about gauge fixing and so on. And all of these details are really crucial in thinking things through. Otherwise, one gets rather confused as we go along. Okay, and another possibility which I already mentioned was to say, suppose we had higher derivatives coming into play, and the curvature was of order this comma, which could have been the string scale. Yesterday, Albion corrected me. I was a little muddled. The string scale would have to be smaller than since my laptop didn't work, the corrections didn't go in. But so it would have to be a little smaller than the gut scale, but anyway, could be of order 10 to the 14 GeV or so, still a very high scale, then this would be important. Now it could be, I haven't written down higher derivative terms involving the scalar fields, and it could be that those scalar fields, those higher derivative terms are small compared to the ones I write down in the metric, because the scalar rolls slowly. This is a possibility, but it doesn't have to be, okay? But at least there is some sort of scenario you can think of where you might incorporate higher derivative terms which still preserve the approximate conformal invariance and don't have to keep those which might ruin it. Okay, and so that's another scenario where this would be, this kind of thinking would apply. Okay, let me just summarize before I go ahead the basic assumptions we are making. That there's an approximate conformal symmetry. The breaking of conformal invariance can be measured in terms of various slow roll parameters. I mentioned those which come from the metric. Since there's a scalar field, there's also a slow roll parameter, which is just how slowly the scalar field rolls compared to the Hubble scale. That also has to be less than 1. This parameter I'll call epsilon, and it'll be important as we go along.
Quick question. So you can sort of cleanly see that the breaking of scale symmetry is small in those parameters. And I guess, well, you can also see that for the special conformal transformations. Is that obvious?
That depends on the model, actually. That, as I was trying to say, yes, that really does depend on the model. Within a particular...
Well, just say, let's think about slow roll, just plain old slow roll.
Oh, yeah, yes. Yes, in plain old slow roll, that's correct. These parameters are enough. If they're all small, then you really have...
Okay, then you can quantifiably say that the breaking of the special conformal guides is...
That's correct. Okay. That's correct. Exactly right.
Just to be difficult, with resonant non-Gaussianity, is it true?
Okay, now, right. Now, I was going to come to this, and that's type T1 scalar field here. I was going to come to this, that what we will actually calculate are the primordial non-Gaussianities, or the primordial correlations, if you like. And then what I've learned in this workshop itself is that sometimes at the end of inflation, you can produce additional non-Gaussianity. And if so, that might not, even if the inflationary dynamics preserves approximate conformal invariance, that might not. Is that right? Isn't resonant non-Gaussianity what happens in preheating or reheating or something? No?
No.
Oh, sorry. I guess I haven't.
It's also a non-Gaussianity produced by resonance. But
that's
a different
parametric resonance.
Oh. This is something else? During inflation?
It's like the 60 E fold, yeah. It comes from modulating the potential.
I see. But then wouldn't you be breaking approximate conformal invariance with that potential, because at points if you would roll fast?
It still feels slow roll situation yet. It would have the effects that I'm asking you whether they, that you get non-Gaussianity that's large in that case, even though the slow roll parameter is small, because it's the sort of resonant cancellation of phases in the calculation of the three-point function.
So you don't see it in terms of the slow roll parameters. I see.
Well, overall, there's
locally. I thought the jump through at points, you sort of have a fast. Okay. Is that right? Let me put it like this. For canonical slow roll, if it really were the case that you started here and the potential really could be expanded as constant plus slow variations compared to the Hubble scale, then the small perturbations really could just be governed by this dynamics, which is very simple.
The effective field theory language is just a question of whether you can get away with just working for the first few terms in the pi's, or if you need the full G upper 0, 0. To capture everything that's going on.
I see. Okay. I haven't thought about it, and there's probably a way to translate this, but I think in those situations, then you probably will violate conformal invariance, is my guess. You might have to quantify it in some additional way. So, all right, at least for normal potentials in canonical slow roll, for the usual kind of potential that I'm familiar with, this additional condition for the slow roll is usually enough to bring about. Maybe there's a more careful way to say it. In terms of potential. Yeah, go ahead.
Another question before, when you say you add these higher derivative terms, these r squared, r cubed, suppressed by either lambda squared or lambda to the fourth. Now, each power of r in the Zeta space is Hubble squared, roughly, right?
Yes.
And when you put Hubble to lambda, I mean, they're all important. They come all in at the same order as r, so
yes.
Right?
Yes.
So then you can't neglect them anymore.
No, you can't. That was my whole point. You can't neglect them. And if it was the string scale, we wouldn't know how to proceed. Yeah. But if the symmetries are still reasonably good, then consequences from symmetry should still be okay. So this is the answer. Yeah.
I mean, in some sense, things are better about like higher derivative terms gotten from integrating out heavy fields. Suppose you don't worry about rolling and the thing is straight to Sitter space and you have a bunch of heavy fields.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can integrate them out and you'll have dead-on conformal invariants. You know, so things have to organize themselves in a way where whatever higher derivative fields you get come from shifts of anomalous dimensions or whatever.
Yeah.
But
I agree with you. If you had the Sitter and higher derivative fields, higher massive fields, you integrate them out, you wouldn't ruin the sitting ones. That's correct.
But as you say, the denominators might actually be the value of the field.
In a rolling
situation.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it could be trickier, but in a rolling situation, so it's not always the case that the small perturbations inherit the symmetries of just the metric. I agree.
Okay.
Okay. So I'm going to make a couple of additional assumptions. One is that there's only one scalar field. This can be relaxed, but I put it in because otherwise you have these isocurvature modes and translating what one calculates in terms of a particular set of modes to what finally are the curvature perturbations is trickier. So let's put that in. And I'm also going to assume that we start with the initial state, which is the bunch, vacuum. I had all these spell check corrections in the version that didn't get shown because my laptop didn't work. Sorry about that. So we'll assume the bunch Davies vacuum, and this is, if you wish, actually part of our assumption of conformal invariance, because the bunch Davies vacuum, as you'll see, preserves conformal invariance, but if you chose some other crazy vacuum, which anyway would not be very well controlled, I think, in terms of back reaction, that wouldn't in general preserve the approximate conformal invariance of this Sitter space, and so then our considerations won't apply. Okay, now it's useful going into the second part of the talk in terms of organizing the discussion to actually think in terms of how the symmetries act on the wave function. And the wave function of the universe, this is not something that's natural for someone who at least comes at things from the particle physics point of view. Because we're not really used to thinking in terms of wave functions, but of course it's a natural way to think in cosmology. And the statement of symmetries is simple to state, because if the state is symmetric, the wave function is invariant under the symmetry transformation up to a possible phase. And once you ensure this about the wave function, you ensure it about any correlation function you would compute from the wave function. So it's an efficient way to impose conditions. In particle physics, we don't think about a wave function. Rather, we think in terms of an S matrix, because we're interested in, for a given in state, what happens at some late time, the resulting out state. And as I said, in cosmology, rather, we're interested in correlation functions at an given instant of time, so a wave function is natural. And the reason I dwell on this is that, in fact, this difference will be very important when we compute correlation functions. For example, it'll turn out that for the correlation functions of interest here in cosmology, contact terms are very important. And these contribute to observational effects as importantly as non-contact terms. We'll work in momentum space, and contact terms will be terms which are analytic in one or more of the momenta. and correspond to delta functions in position space. These are not things one normally needs to worry about when you compute the S matrix, because I guess the LSD reduction means you look at holes and so on. But they'll be as important as the other non-analytic terms when it comes to this calculation. And for me, this was really the new element, having to understand and figure out what the contact terms are correctly, is really sort of the new element that the cosmology calculation introduces. And I think it's the main subtlety in getting things right in this whole business, in my view. Okay, so what we'll be interested in is the wave function at late times. We're interested in modes which grow exponentially as the universe expands and ultimately leave the horizon and freeze out. And we are interested in the correlation functions in those modes after they have left the horizon. So in that sense, for any mode, we are interested in the late time wave function. We'll start, as I said, with the Bunch Davies vacuum. And at some late time, if we denote a generic mode as chi of x, Since once it leaves the horizon, it stops time developing, it becomes independent of time, we'll then be interested in the wave function, which is a functional of chi. Okay? So that's what we'll be interested in. And if you have a system which is close to Gaussian, which we know from the beginning because we know fluctuation should be small, we're putting that in the system of interest. So if you have a system which is close to Gaussian, then schematically you can write the wave function in this way. You can write an exponential of something which is bilinear. This is what you'd get if you had just a Gaussian field, plus corrections, which you could organize systematically in terms of higher powers of the field, so a trilinear, a fourth power, and so on. These coefficients, I'm writing in a suggestive way for now, but they're really just, for the moment, coefficients which appear in the wave function. So the coefficient of the Gaussian term I'm calling with brackets OX, OY, and then similarly for the trilinear term and so on. And I'm doing that, of course, because what will happen as we talk about symmetries is that these coefficients, we'll argue, will have the right symmetries for correlation functions in a conformal field theory. So that's how we'll map things. The coefficient functions, which appear in the wave function, which then determine all the correlation functions, those coefficient functions will have the right symmetries, will map to correlation functions in a conformal field theory, and will have the same symmetry properties as the corresponding correlation functions. So, and the symmetry conditions will just be then constraints on these coefficient functions. And just to say this, the coefficient functions will behave like the operators under conformal symmetry. Okay, and so this is the central idea of the analysis, that using this we will recast our study of symmetries into questions about constraints imposed in a conformal field theory on the appropriate correlators. Okay, and then we'll ask whether the correlators in the CFT are completely fixed or to what extent, and that in turn will then tell us about the correlation functions for inflation. Okay, so that's the basic idea. Just to illustrate it, it's probably not necessary here, but anyway, suppose this perturbation was a scalar, and we were thinking about the scaling symmetry, which is a coordinate transformation since it's an isometry. Then we know how the scalar field transforms under it. Delta phi goes to delta phi prime, another function of x and t, which is determined in terms of the functional form of delta phi. And now suppose it were the case that the wave function were invariant under the scaling symmetry, then psi as a functional of delta phi should be the same as psi as a functional of delta phi, psi which is a functional of delta phi of x should be the same functional when you evaluate it on another function which is delta phi of x over lambda. Okay, and now, if you look at the expansion for psi, it involved various, it was this Gaussian plus corrections. Roughly every additional power of the perturbation came, this is a bit schematic, came with a coefficient function I was labeling with an additional operator and some integral. And therefore, in a schematic way at least, which you can make more precise, sorry, where did it go? So you have, if chi were delta phi, for every additional chi you get an O, and therefore the whole the wave function would be invariant if, in a schematic way, integral d cube x delta phi of x over lambda O of x must actually equal the same thing when evaluated for a functional delta phi of x. Okay, and that more precisely means within correlation functions that this equality should hold. And after a little bit of algebra, that means basically that you have scale invariance if these coefficient functions O of x are such that when I take O of x to lambda cube O of lambda x, then the coefficient functions should remain invariant. That's exactly the property you get if O of x was a dimension 3 operator in a conformal field theory, which is to say that under a scaling transformation where O transforms with its scaling properties, correct scaling properties, the correlator remains invariant. Okay, so.
Are you assuming that delta phi doesn't get an anomalous dimension here?
Delta phi is a field in the bulk.
Sure.
So, for example, you could have a scalar field in the bulk, and what you're doing, the scaling transformation is just a coordinate transformation which leaves the metric unchanged. So any scalar under a coordinate transformation behaves like a scalar does, and that tells us the transformation of delta phi.
Okay.
And then we translate that, if the wave function is symmetric, we translate that into a statement about how the coefficient functions must behave. Okay, and the remaining point just to make is why would we expect the wave function to be symmetric under the conformal group? And the idea is you can think about the late time wave function actually as just obtained by starting with our initial conditions, which are Bunch-Davies, and then integrating to the late time of interest. The wave function can then be evaluated by doing the path integral with the action of the theory and given these boundary conditions at late time. So this is like a Hartle-Hawking, if you wish, like prescription. The only change is that you're imposing the Bunch-Davies boundary conditions here. And we are actually working in co-moving time, if you like, in a Poincaré patch rather than in global dissipator. So that actually defines the wave function. And then from this definition, it's very easy to see that the wave function actually inherits the symmetries of de Sitter space, because the symmetries are isometries, and the path integral is invariant under coordinate transformations, so in particular under these isometries, which don't change the functional form of these perturbations. And so that tells us then that if chi goes to chi prime of B, another function, that psi evaluated on the original function must be the same as that evaluated on chi prime. Okay, so just from very simple considerations, as long as the Bunch-Davies vacuum is conformally invariant, which it is, it follows that the wave function must have these symmetries. And the simplest way to think about why the Bunch-Davies vacuum is actually conformally invariant is because the physics behind the Bunch-Davies vacuum is you take any mode at late time and you go back in time, it gets to be of shorter and shorter wavelength till it's really very short in wavelength compared to the Hubble scale or its mass or any other scale. And at that point, the field is just behaving as if it were a scalar field, as if it were a massless scalar field in flat space, because all effects of curvature and so on have gone away. The Bunch-Davies vacuum amounts to taking that scalar field to be in its Poincaré vacuum, okay, at those early times. And that, if you take a massless scalar field in flat space in the Poincaré vacuum, that is a conformally invariant state, and it follows from that that the Bunch-Davies vacuum is also conformally invariant. And you can say it in terms of more fancy contours and so on in the path integral, but anyway, it's true, and from that, therefore, follows the symmetries of the wave function, that it would be invariant under this whole symmetry group. So now, to go ahead, I have to tell you a little bit more. This might be a little boring, but let me be precise in the talk. I have to tell you a little bit more in more precise detail about the perturbations of interest and how then they map to operators. So you can use these symmetries to organize our discussion of perturbations in de Sitter space or in the inflationary background. There's rotational invariance, as I said, and you can use that to organize the perturbations, and there are two kinds. There's a tensor perturbation, which is the graviton, and there's a scalar perturbation, which is spin zero. Okay, so these are well known, these are the two perturbations. If we write the metric in ADM form, which I've written here with N and Ni being the lapse and shift functions, then you can expand Hij as the scale factor I was writing before, times something proportional to delta ij, a trace part, and gamma ij, which is traceless. And you can also choose coordinates so that it's transverse. And then with that choice, gamma ij is the graviton or the spin 2 perturbation. And it's very easy to define. All the subtleties in inflation, as you know, come in having to define the scalar perturbation carefully. And physically, the scalar perturbation arises because you have an inflaton, which can fluctuate, so you have one extra scalar degree of freedom. But that can mix with the metric, so it can mix with zeta, which is also a scalar under rotations, so you have to be a little careful. And so you expand the inflaton, that gives you a perturbation delta phi. So you have two scalars here, delta phi and zeta. And there are two gauges to think about, and it really helps to work in the correct gauge in terms of clarifying confusions. One gauge where you choose your coordinates, which you can always do to set the perturbation in the inflaton to be zero, and then the perturbations you're left with are in the curvature, zeta, or gauge 2, which is actually the one we'll use for our calculations to calculate the perturbations produced during inflation. This is the gauge where you set the curvature to be, where you set zeta, the curvature perturbation, to be 0, so it's flat, and all the fluctuations are in delta phi. Okay, and this gauge is convenient to use because you'll see the limit where you recover conformal invariance is much clearer here rather than in the other gauge. To go between the two gauges, you have to do a time reparameterization. That tells you that delta phi in the second gauge is related to zeta in the first gauge through a factor which involves one of the slow roll parameters. Okay, it involves phi dot over h. And that means if I were to invert this and write zeta in terms of delta phi, 1 over phi dot would appear in the denominator, and then you can get really confused about what the phi dot going to 0 limit is. Okay, so it's really important to think about the gauges correctly. So we'll work in this gauge where the scalar perturbation is just the perturbations in the inflaton, a scalar field, during inflation. But what we'll do is at the end of inflation, we will then use this gauge transformation to map the result to the zeta variable. And the reason for that is that the zeta, after inflation is done, first of all, it's kind of strange to be talking in terms of fluctuations of the inflaton. But more also, just more technically, there's a beautiful result that it is zeta which is then conserved in the subsequent evolution of the universe. And so if we compute zeta at the end of inflation, then we know what it would be much later as well. Okay, so we'll do this two-step thing. We'll really do our calculations in this gauge where the perturbation is just in delta phi, and then at the end, translate everything into fluctuations of zeta. Okay, so that's a little bit of technicality, but that's what we'll do. And now, working in the second gauge, we can write the wave function. You have two kinds of perturbations. There's the scalar perturbation, so there's the Gaussian part in the scalar perturbation, the Gaussian part in the graviton fluctuations. The gravitons are also traceless and transverse. And then there are three-point correlators, one of which I've written down here. The three-point correlators, there's delta phi gamma ij, times a coefficient function which I'm denoting as O, O, T, I, J, and then other things here. And I single this one out because this is what we'll be after is the three-point correlator involving two scalars and one graviton, and it's this coefficient function that will be then important for us to determine that correlation function. Okay. And as I said, the coefficient functions will transform correctly under conformal transformations if O of X and Tij transform like a scalar operator of dimension 3 and the stress energy tensor of a conformal field theory under conformal transformations. Okay, so that's really all we are using about a CFT, that these coefficient functions are really transforming just as corresponding correlators of a scalar of appropriate dimension 3, a marginal operator scalar, and the stress energy tensor. The way they transform. So that's all we are using. There's one more property which is crucial, which is, as you know, that the stress energy tensor of a CFT is also conserved. And that gives rise to odd identities, which also impose restrictions on CFT correlators. That is equally true for these coefficient functions, and it arises as follows. The wave function, as I already mentioned this to some extent, the wave function, the way we've defined it, is invariant under coordinate transformations, under reparameterizations in particular, where xi goes to xi plus some function v vi of x. And if you demand that invariance of the wave function, that again, it turns out, gives rise to exactly the Ward identities for these coefficient functions. So in fact, both the Ward identities of the conformal field theory and the symmetry properties will be there for us to use. Now, one very important technical point is that we will work in momentum space. And I say this because oftentimes in conformal field theory, calculations are really done in position space. And that is, in fact, more convenient for many purposes. But of course, for observational purposes in cosmology, we really want the momentum space answer. And the reason why this I emphasize this is that you can't directly Fourier transform often position space answers to momentum space because the Fourier transforms are not well defined. And this is related to what happens when operators come together. You can get singularities when operators come together. And to resolve, to correctly understand what happens there, you also have to figure out this whole issue I mentioned about contact terms. And that's quite a thorny issue, the allowed contact terms, to what extent they are fixed by conformal invariants and so on and so forth. That has to be all fixed if you hope to be able to do the Fourier transform. So it gets kind of tricky, although the position space starting point has some virtues and advantages, gets somewhat tricky. So instead, what we'll do is just work directly in Fourier space here to compute, to impose the Ward identity and the constraints of conformal invariants and then determine the corresponding correlator. Okay, so at this point, I'm going to just show you how everything works. It's a little boring, but still it's kind of interesting how everything works for one specific operator, which will then determine the three-point correlator I mentioned, two scalars, and one stress energy tensor. So at this point, we completely now change to thinking about conformal field theory. We have a 3D Euclidean conformal field theory. It has two operators, which will be of interest for us, one dimension three marginal operator, and the stress energy tensor. And what can we say just from the symmetries then about this three-point correlator? Okay, and you'll see in fact that the symmetries fix it completely, which is quite nice. Okay, so for how do we start this analysis? All my transparency. I'm sorry about this, but you start by just using rotational invariants to try and write down the most general functional forms that can appear for this operator. In general, you might think that you have many rotationally invariant functions. There's, of course, the magnitudes of k1, k2, and k3. But there's also, for example, k1 dot k2. However, because of overall momentum conservation, translational invariance, which results in the momentum conservation, you can always express k1 dot k2, for example, in terms of k1 plus k2 square minus k1 square plus k2 square. And this is k3 square. So those don't give rise to independent invariants. So all the invariants are just the magnitudes of the three momenta. And then you can just write down, this has two indices. So you can write down various ways to soak up those indices in terms of the momenta. And that gives you basically, and use the fact that things must be symmetric under the exchange of the two scalars. So basically, that allows you to write this operator in terms of three unknown functions of the magnitudes of the three momenta, k1, k2, and k3, so f1, f2, and f3. If you can determine these, you can determine the correlation function. Okay, now from scale invariants, so far we've used translational invariants and rotational invariants. From scale invariants, the dimension of these operators has to be 1. That's very easy to see. Skip over that detail. Now we've used all these sort of obvious symmetries, and now we ask about the special conformal invariants. And the invariance under that takes this form that the change of OK1 and similarly the change of OK2 and the change of OK3, all three in these correlation functions should amount to no change at all. And that gives rise to three, because you have three special conformal transformations, three second order differential equations in these momenta. Okay, and this is because the change of this operator under a conformal transformation involves d tilde, where d tilde is a second order operator in terms of the momenta. Similarly, the change in the stress energy tensor also involves a second order operator. So you get three second order differential equations, which have to be met. And then finally, there's the Ward identity of stress energy conservation. And that takes some, if I write the stress, the correlator up to some delta function as mij, that takes some fairly precise form. So that needs to be imposed. So that's all that goes into the mix. And it turns out these second order differential equations can be solved, and the most general solution can be written as follows. It's, since we are going to be ultimately interested in the correlator in inflation, which involves a transverse traceless graviton, it's good enough to just compute this correlator dotted with some polarization, which is also transverse and traceless, and then the answer can be written up to some normalization, which is fixed in terms of the two-point function of OO, can be written, and the delta function can be written in terms of S, which is a scalar made out of the magnitudes of K1, K2, and K3, where S is a little complicated, okay, but you can obtain it explicitly, is the sum of four functional forms. Okay, so here N1 and N2 can take values either +1 or -1, so there are four terms in this sum with coefficients M, N1, N2, which are not fixed by the differential equations. And so if we take N1 and N2 +1, then, you know, here you get, this becomes N1, N2 is 1, so you get minus K2, K3 over K1 plus K2 plus K3 whole square, plus so on, and similarly for other choices. There are some conditions on these coefficients, which are that they have to sum weighted with the N1 values to 1, etc. So that's the most general solution. So we are not led to a unique solution so far, just imposing all the symmetries in the problem. But there's something else which we can now impose, which is the analog of the operator product expansion in a conformal field theory, which is to ask what happens when the operators come close together. And these have a direct, so we can consider special limits, and it turns out when you consider the behavior in the special limits, then that really fixes the form of the correlator completely. And so there are two kinds of special limits. We have these two scalars have momenta K1 and K2, and the graviton has momentum K3. So you can either take the graviton to have a momentum much smaller than K1 and K2, or one of the scalars to have a momentum much smaller than the other scalar and the graviton. And these actually have the statement of the OPE has a direct analog in the bulk. For example, in the limit where the graviton has a very small momentum, basically what happens is you're computing the two-point scalar correlator in an essentially constant background, which is generated by the graviton having some constant value. And that is basically just a coordinate transformation of De Sitter space. So using that fact, you can in fact relate the behavior, even from the bulk point of view in this limit, to the behavior of just the two-point scalar correlator. And these kind of relations were also discussed by Maldacena from the bulk point of view, and they are called Maldacena consistency conditions in the literature now. But they again map to something we all know about in conformal field theory, namely what happens in various limits when operators come together. And so maybe I'll just jump over things. When you actually impose these two limits, then you're led to a unique answer. And here is the unique answer. It's a little complicated. And what I've done now is I got the unique answer for the operator in the conformal field theory. And then from there, I computed the physical correlator in the bulk, which requires doing a few, because you have a wave function. What that gives you is a wave function. And then from wave function, you have to go to expectation value. So you have to do a little more processing. But anyway, after all that, here is the answer. There's, of course, the delta function due to energy momentum conservation. There are these factors which arise because you compute an expectation value. So they are the sort of pole factors. Then there's the normalization, which is fixed, which involves PS and PT. And you see here that the two-point tensor perturbation, the two-point scalar perturbation, the power in that is PS. So this is what has been measured and is about 10 to the minus 10. The two-point correlator, the graviton, its power is PT. So the entire normalization is then fixed in terms of the two-point correlators of the scalar and tensor perturbations. And this function S, after putting all these conditions, out of the four possible forms, only one is allowed, and it takes this very simple explicit form.
I'm going to ask a silly sociology question. Since you argued that the symmetries determine everything in the special case of simplest single field soil, were these not computed in Vaughan's paper?
They were computed, but what was not clear, so maybe I wasn't clear, the single slow roll model is an example where you have approximate conformal invariance, but it wasn't clear that approximate conformal invariance would uniquely fix this form. And so that's actually what we have shown, that that leads to a unique form, and indeed one of the first checks then is to check whether So the functional form is completely fixed, the normalization is fixed, etc. And indeed, the first thing you would do is to check against the calculation in the canonical case, which was done by Maldacena, and they agree. Of course, what really happened was we first didn't get it to agree, and then, you know, found the errors in our calculations. The answer is small. Roughly speaking, you know, if you took a three-point scalar correlator, people measure its strength in terms of this FNL parameter, as you know, and FNL is now bounded to be 2 with some error of 5 or so. I mean, has been measured to be 2 plus minus 5 or something. In that way of thinking, this amounts to FNL of order epsilon, the slow roll parameter. That's just because of the way the normalizations go in and so on. And so it's very small, and actually made even smaller by the fact that you've got a tensor perturbation here, so they'd actually have to make sure that they're computing a three-point correlator involving a tensor perturbation. So this is a challenging observation to do for sure, but assuming in the future that they could do it, it's a really beautiful test of conformal invariance, because really it's so completely fixed. You have a template which is given to you against which you have to fix, you have to check your measurements, and if the template happens to agree with the one, then you really are verifying conformal invariance, a very detailed check of that, and if it doesn't, you know, then you're ruling out the fact that the early universe was conformally invariant.
Just to make sure I follow you, I mean, Juan's calculation was a tree-level calculation, right? When you say this is unique, you mean that even after you include loop effects and so forth, it still has to have exactly the same form?
Yeah, in some model, loop effects might come in and so on, but as long as conformal invariance was good.
Preserved, then you must have this in the same relationship to the two-point functions and so forth. So
yes.
It's a loop-form way, no matter how many orders you.
That's right. It turns out that the Watt identities of energy momentum conservation relate the overall normalization to the two-point function, and then everything is fixed about it. That's right.
Yeah. So you say it's basically, well, symmetries plus normalization conditions that come from the squeezed limit, what you call the OPE limit.
Yeah.
But in some sense, those relationships really, they sort of come from the symmetry too. They're saying that if you have a, you know, very long wavelength fluctuation and you look at the two-point function in that background, then effectively you can transform away the long wavelength fluctuation, so you know what the correlator is.
Yeah.
So, to what extent is that separate data?
It's not separate data, I'm sorry. I would say it's symmetries that are fixing the correlator, but in terms of just the analysis, there were a set of differential equations the symmetries directly give rise to. The solutions to those are not unique, but then when you put in the additional data, which is also symmetry driven from the limits, then it is unique. So I think it's all symmetries. Just that statement was more about the way the calculation was done. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So why is it harder to do three scalars? You think of
I'll come to that in a minute. Yeah, that's right. That would be the more interesting thing to do. Okay, now just to tell you about this technicality of contact terms. You know, here was the answer for S, and you see, for example, there's a term here which only depends on one of the K1, which only depends on one of the momenta. It's independent of the other two momenta. So in particular, since it's independent, it's of course an analytic function of the other momenta, and that means when you Fourier transform this result back to position space, these will give rise to contact terms, where if you, in position space, you have three operators as three locations, x, y, and z, two of them would, then you'd have a delta function or some derivative of the delta function as a Fourier transform of this. And that tells you that what we've really done by doing the momentum space analysis is not only fixed the form of this correlator when the two, three points were not coincident, but also fixed all the contact term ambiguity. Okay. Anyway, in fact, the position space correlator was calculated a long time ago for OOTIJ by Osborne and Petkow, but at non-coincident points, and we actually started here, but then we got terribly confused about how to fix the contact terms and how to organize our discussion of symmetries. That might be an alternate way to go, but for us, this was easier.
Okay, can I ask, what was the crucial principle that fixed the contact terms? Was it the,
They seem to be together. You need both the pieces of data, the OPEs as well as the differential equations together. We couldn't narrow it down. You know, you got this set of four possible terms if you just use the differential equations. And each of them have terms which would contribute to contact terms. and then you killed off various things using the OPE, and then you were just left with.
You say the OPEs are fixed, or sorry, the OPEs fix the contact terms. That's the first thing.
No, it's more, yeah, it's a little more, let me show you if I can show you these terms. So, you know, if you chose any particular choice of N1 and N2, you would get these terms. And these are all, for example, contact terms. And what the OPE tells you, but what the differential equations tell you is that, well, it's a sum of four possible terms. And then what the OPE tells you is, by looking at the singularity structure, essentially, it tells you that the only singularities which can appear are the ones where you have K1 plus K2 plus K3. If you got K1 minus K2, if the signs were not aligned, then that's not allowed. And so it throws off three of these possible terms and the related contact terms together. So it's a sort of joint analysis that gets rid of it. It wasn't just directly the contact terms, the OPEs that got rid of it. Okay, and then let me just end it, because I've already gone ahead over time, and I apologize, I started late. But okay. So just the summary is that conformal invariance can sometimes be a powerful constraint. The correlator discussed here serves as a good model, as a good model independent probe, as I said, for approximate conformal invariance. It's a good way to try and check, although very hard to measure. What about other correlators? And we are still thinking about this. The first, of course, the natural question is, what about the three-point scalar operator? And it turns out that this, the reason why this operator, this correlation function is challenging is that in the exact conformally invariant limit, this correlation function vanishes. And that maps to the fact that if you had, as I said, you know, the corresponding operator in the CFT is a exactly marginal scalar operator, and if you had an exactly marginal operator, its three-point function on general grounds vanishes. And so the first correction itself involves the breaking of conformal invariance, and so that makes it a little trickier to think about. But we're still trying to think about this some more.
Sorry, why keep it exactly marginal? You know, all you need is a hierarchy between the
Yeah.
Exactly.
It doesn't have to be. Yeah. In the way we are thinking. Yeah. So you could put in the breaking like that, and then say that.
I mean, I'm saying that's not a breaking conformal invariance itself.
Yeah. All right. You could make it depart from exact conformal exact marginality, but. Yeah, it's a little more, the physical, you know, if you had a massive field in ADS, then the corresponding perturbations don't become time independent at late enough time. M square, yeah, that's true. That's true. But that, in my language, would be putting in the first breakings of conformal invariance, because in an M square phi square, if M square is smaller than H square, let's say you're doing some hilltop or something, then to begin with you have conformal invariance, and then M square over H square is one of the slow roll parameters, So for this reason, we can talk about it a little more. There might be some things to do, but at least the analysis is a little more complicated, because the direct limit where you just put all the slow roll parameters to zero and compute the leading term, that gives you zero here. This follows from a general argument just in conformal field theory, as I was saying. It has been noticed in this special limit where one of the momenta is much bigger than the others, using the sort of Maldacena kind of argument, but the map to conformal field theory tells you that in general, even away from those limits in momentum space, it must be small. And so at least one sort of consequence of conformal invariance is that FNL is order epsilon. This is, of course, somewhat, you know, unfortunate from the point of view of measurement. To put it another way, if they did measure the three-point correlator and they found it to be bigger than epsilon, order epsilon, then that would again rule out the fact that the universe was approximately conformally invariant. So it still has some, the fact that you can make a very generic statement about the order of magnitude still has some predictability in it. Okay. So that's kind of interesting. And the four-point function, actually, unlike the three-point function, does not have to vanish in the exactly conformally invariant limit. But you don't get a unique answer that you expect anyway, even from, say, an analysis in position space, because now when you're in three-dimensional conformal field theory, it turns out there are two invariant cross ratios, invariant under the conformal group, and this can be any function of those cross ratios and still be conformally invariant, any suitable function. So it won't be fixed uniquely, but again, its magnitude is fixed, and when you translate that to the parameters they use for observation, tau nl and gnl, again, they're very small, and in this case, it really hurts you because of the four-point function. The present bounds are the tau nl is like 1,000, and these are saying that they're order epsilon, but again, that means if they measure tau nl and gnl to be bigger than order of the slow roll parameters, then you know that it cannot be approximately a conformally invariant system like this. So again, that's the fact that it's a very generic statement is worth making. And perhaps future large-scale experiments or large-scale structure at least, and it's a try. If they can't measure something so small, can at least maybe rule out the fact by measuring a larger signal that this was the scenario at play. So, well, here's the map, here's my picture, and if you look very carefully, you'll see the words CFT imprinted in the CMB. All right, thank you. Yes. This is the power asymmetry. They have two power asymmetries: large L and small L.
Yeah, either one.
Okay. No. That's true. That would. If it accumulates enough statistical significance, I think then.
I wish I hadn't heard the word serious. I might think the thing to expand around, like turn off, imagine you have a scalar field like the inflaton, mm-hmm. just turn off the inflaton potential, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and that would be the reference. But I guess there, you think of the scalar field, I guess the two and three point functions in the scalar field are there, but they're logarithmically divergent. Right, because the scalar field correlator grows logarithmically mm-hmm. with separation. Yeah, so do you somehow have a reference theory here? Supposed to be a logarithmic conformal field theory?
Let's see.
You just take 5x, 5y, and this DLCFT for a mass equals zero scalar field. Mm-hmm. I think its correlations grow logarithmically. That must be true, right?
You're thinking of the growing variance, or
just the correlator in some stupid way.
You could do various calculations. If you start in this sort of, here we are actually looking at the whole calculation, I think, in a patch, because we just do it in the Poincaré patch with the Bunch-Davis vacuum conditions. Okay. Will it still grow? Doesn't the correlation function freeze out once the modes?
I think it's the freezing out that grows logarithmically.
You accumulate fluctuations at longer and longer, at long distances as you drive more and more fluctuations outside the horizon. And that's the mechanism.
That's true, but a particular mode number, I guess, would freeze out to some particular two-point covariance, right? That is the physical.
The issue is the massless scalar field. There's no there is no secondary vacuum state for it, so its wave function doesn't exist for that field.
That is the limit we are calculating it. Because when you do, for example, before we do anything very fancy, if you just do the standard calculation in inflation, you do it for a massless field, and you don't for any mode. Maybe if you allowed the E folding to go on forever. But in position space, what you get is this standard correlation function,
But maybe you're,
the things that are good operators in conformal field theory are derivatives in this field.
Well, but the inflaton is not the derivative. Suppose you care about the inflaton.
Yeah, you just get the usual scale invariant answer. So perhaps what you're saying is that
like a reference. We always think the good reference is to turn the inflaton potential off.
Yes, I agree. So then you have a mass.
Kind of a singular limit.
Maybe the divergence is
a logarithmic CFT.
But maybe the divergence is just that you have, if you have dk over k, there is a log divergence there.
That's
the
log.
So you see that. You see that. That's true. But, and that's the, the Harrison-Zeldovich thing, which will get corrected slightly because of the slow roll things. But you will have this divergence. I guess, you compute it momentum mode by momentum mode, yeah. And you're not too worried.
It's not a fact.
But that's true. You would have this divergence if you went down to k equal to 0. And I guess what you really do is you don't allow inflation to go on forever, so the modes which have crossed up to any epoch have some non-zero momentum, and then non-zero k, and then that's a cutoff which regulates the answer.
Transformations apply, right?
Yeah, but
transformation of the fluctuations of the gravitational potential, there's this slow roll factor.
Well, yeah, there is a slow roll. That's okay. That's not what Steve's complaining about. I mean, that's just you can use another field. You have zeta, which is some h over phi dot times delta phi. So when you.
Yeah, that'll work.
That's just some factor of this, which is just you used a particular field variable.
Yeah, but I'm just wondering, you were worried about the problems in computing the three-scalar.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some way that this limit, when you turn, I always thought DSCFT is a conformal field theory, and that's the right thing when you have no inflaton potential. But, I mean, when you have an inflaton field with no potential, that's kind of a singular CFT. Singular limit.
I agree with
and
you.
That's kind of what you were.
And we are working in that singular limit. I agree, but I think that singularity doesn't come back and get us for the reason that we don't. We are not interested in letting. One way to try and answer that, I would say, is we're not interested in letting inflation go on forever.
Yeah, that cuts it off.
And that would cut it off. And. Sort of more practical in our view. If you did let it go on forever, I agree. There is that divergence, and you'd have to deal with it.
By the way, there's a similar problem for the graviton fluctuations, and we do believe that future inflation potentially goes on forever. So if you're thinking about how to define the wave function for the future of the universe, you've got the same problem.
This is some eternal inflation issue.
We're
think into De Sitter space, right? If we look to our future, and you have the same effect for the graviton fluctuations,
right?
And so you do get these what look like infrared divergences, which you see the effect of a very long time. You have a growing variance with time.
Is that a curvature invariant or something?
No, it's hard. The question is what kinds of diff invariant observables you need to measure this, and they aren't particularly simple. They're not local things.
So that's what I was going to ask. Are they really physical divergences, the IR?
I think they are in the sense that, there's diff invariant information in the wave function. You have to look at some.
Yeah, all right, I don't have much to say about that. We don't encounter it in this because you just work for some restricted set of mode numbers.
So. That means you're kind of cutting off your, it's kind of like...
That's right. You have to put this time slice where we compute the wave function at some finite time.
And if you took it away, as we might like to do in a CFT, you get trouble.
I agree. Okay. You put it because here you're more practical in just computing the correlations generated.
Yeah, so maybe you call the thing a logarithmic CFT, CFT.
I see. Okay.
Fixing it up or something.
Okay, with a cutoff. That's
something in life.
Yeah.
Can you extend the story to a perturbative extension?
That's right. You could try to do that. You could try to do that to systematically include the slow roll effects. A natural way to think is in terms of conformal perturbation theory, but it's not entirely clear that would apply because in conformal perturbation theory there are actually two expansions you do. One is that you turn on an operator which has, let's say, a small anomalous dimension, so it's nearly marginal, and you, if you like, perturb in that difference between the dimension -3 or something. But the other is that you only go some small distance in RG space, And it's not clear that going that small distance is enough for 60 foldings and so on. So I don't have a definite answer whether you can always control things in the conformal perturbation theory or not for this purpose. But in some cases you might be, but that might introduce some more model dependence. So we're still looking at it. We're not sure that you would always be able to get an answer using that. There are some claims in the literature that conformal perturbation theory will break down and so on. So we're still trying to sort that out. Okay, but it's a natural question, I agree, to think about.
Yeah, so I was just going to, it's about if the universe is really, really big compared to our Hubble patch, and you have some local, not if your statistics depend on the background in some way, like local non-Gaussianity does, how the level of non-Gaussianity varies.
Okay, so that'll be Thursday at 2 after we win the soccer game tomorrow.